We're going to be reading from the book of Colossians, chapter 1, verses 15 to 20. From verse 15. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross.
Well, have you ever heard of Harry Truman? Not Harry S. Truman, the President of America, but Harry R. Truman, who was an American. He was the caretaker of the Mount St. Helens Lodge near Spirit Lake. Back in the 1980s, he became world-famous celebrity. He's now the subject of several different books. A movie's been made of his life. There's music written about him. And parts of the park have been named after him around Mount St. Helens. Trails, ridges, parks are all named after him. He lived on Mount St. Helens, which is the northwestern part of the United States of America. He was warned that being a volcano, it was going to erupt. But he refused to believe it, and so refused all the orders to leave. "I don't have any idea whether it will blow," he said, "but I don't believe it to the point that I'm going to pack up." Later he said, "If the mountain goes, I'm going with it. This area is heavily timbered. Spirit Lake is in between me and the mountain, and the mountain's a mile away. The mountain ain't going to hurt me." He said, "You couldn't pull me out with a mule team. That mountain's part of Truman, and Truman's part of that mountain." Which, of course, is now true, for when it blew, in fact, he became part of the mountain, buried beneath 46 metres of volcanic debris. Harry Truman was very secure in his belief. He was sincere. He was also totally wrong. Security and insecurity, you'll see I'm at point one on the outline to follow, make it easier for you and note-taking and the rest. Security and insecurity are defined as a state or a feeling about the present, but it's also about the future, though it's actually built on the past. See, it's a present state or feeling. It's present because right now you have security or insecurity. It's sometimes a state that you are safe, but sometimes it's really not so much a state of being safe, it's the feeling of being safe, or insecurity, the feeling of being unsafe. That makes the topic a little confusing, for security and insecurity are both being safe and feeling safe. It's even more confusing because, you see, you can be safe and feel unsafe. And you can feel safe and be unsafe. As emotions go, the feeling of being unsafe is a lot stronger than the feeling of being safe. Insecurity is a profound feeling, very disturbing. But security is almost like an assumption. You don't really notice. It's like housework. You know, when it's done, nobody notices. When it's not done, everybody notices. Or at least your mother does. While security and insecurity are how you feel now, they're actually about the future, about the future reality. We're generally not insecure about the past because we've survived whatever's happened. But we're unsure about the future. See, we can't really control the future. We have a certain sense of control in making plans that we do. I mean, I decide to catch the tram home at 4 o'clock this afternoon. So I go down to the stop and I get on the tram and go home. But you can't be certain about the future, can you? The tram can break down. The prac classes can go too long. The others in my work group don't pull their weight. Ain't that the truth? And then the 3 o'clock lecture's been cancelled, so I can go home at 3, not 4. And I mean, they're just very simple, relatively unimportant illustrations. But it's this uncertainty about the future, this inability to control the future, that gives rise to our insecurity. You don't have to be an adult long to realise that you're not God. You don't control the future. And when we look at more serious matters and think about it, our insecurity rises. For there is insecurity all around about us. There's economic insecurity. Will there be jobs when you graduate? Will you ever be able to afford a house? There's the environmental insecurity. What damage are we really doing? Will I be able to have children when there's been a decrease in sperm count by 50% over the last 50 years? There's political insecurity. What happens if Mr. Trump wins the second term? What happens if Mr. Trump doesn't win the second term? Either way, there's physical insecurity. Am I safe walking around the city at night? There's personal or psychological insecurity. Who am I? What is my identity? There's physiological insecurity. Will I get cancer? What kind of cancer? What if there's another pandemic? And then there's relational insecurity. Who will be my friends? Everybody else seems to have friends. When will I actually have friends like other people seem to have friends? And will I find that special friend with whom I can share a lifetime? And will my parents divorce? And if they divorce, what's going to happen to me? Will I go with Dad? Will I go with Mum? Or will they both leave me? And there's academic security. That's all available for you, isn't it? You know, can I pass this course? Will I do well enough to get a job? And the list just goes on and on. I'm sick of this list if you're not already. It just goes on and on. There's just so many parts of insecurity because our future is so uncertain that we have endless opportunity for insecurity. The trouble is we don't know the future and we cannot control the future because, in fact, we're not in control, we're not God. But most of our insecurity is built on the past. It's our past experiences or knowledge that give us grounds for being secure or reasons for being insecure. If the tram is always on time, then I don't doubt it'll be there today. If it frequently breaks down, then I'm pretty sure, I can't be sure about what's going to happen today. Sometimes past trauma has been so powerful that it disturbs our ability to ever have security about anything. Post-traumatic stress undermines security deeply and profoundly. But usually we rely upon statistical past performance to predict what the future is going to involve. We look at the statistics of plane travel. We see that the plane crashes are very, very rare. And so therefore we put our bodies in a metal can and shoot it above the clouds at enormous speeds, confident that, secure that, it won't happen to us. Some of us, you see, are risk takers, living out often foolhardy security. Some of us are risk averse, and so living out the pain of insecurity. Most of us are somewhere between risk-averse and risk-takers, trying to be unafraid of the risks and at the same time not quite sure about the wisdom of our actions. I mean, there's always hope that something like psychology could help us deal with insecurities that make us better risk-takers, more sensible risk-takers. I mean, psychology has been a profoundly helpful discipline for people with mental health problems. But can it help people with just the everyday issues of life? Well, this has given rise over the last 25 years, in other words, all your lifetime, but just yesterday for me, the discipline called positive psychology. When I did it, you know, way back when, there wasn't positive psychology, everything was abnormal psychology, which made me think psychology was. The father of this positive psychology is a professor, Martin Seligman of Pittsburgh, and instead of psychology being about abnormality or dysfunctional personalities, he promoted positive psychology, teaching about well-being and how to flourish in life, words that have now just moved into common parlance in our language, which weren't there last century. It was about 1998 he coined the phrase positive psychology. Seligman studied and wrote about optimism versus pessimism. He has a very specialised and very simple definition of those two terms, but we don't need to know them to understand the point I'm making. He came to two very important conclusions. Firstly, optimistic success. In general, in every area of life, optimists beat pessimists. Be it sales, be it military training, be it politicians, being teachers, being academic work, the optimists are winners, the pessimists are losers. Basically, optimists take risks and win. Pessimists do nothing and lose. So he produced a very famous non-academic book, a popular book, called Learnt Optimism, where he was training and teaching people how to be optimists, because optimists are winners. However, sadly, he came to a second conclusion that there was one area, only one area in life, but there was one area where pessimists always win. And that is in pessimistic rationality. For people who could make the most accurate predictions about the future were always pessimists. Those who could determine beforehand the likelihood of success and the probability of failure, pessimists. Optimists were hopeless at predicting what the future holds. Pessimists, really accurate about the future. Ponder it, that's a very sad combination of conclusions, isn't it? For the end point is that you do better in life if you're irrational. And optimists all do better in life, so get rid of your thinking, go for it. You got more chance of success. And so the irrational optimists, rather than the rational pessimists, I mean, the logical conclusion to reach is don't look at the evidence. Don't look at the probabilities. Don't think too hard about what may happen. Just jump in and have a go. It's like live like a madman and you've got more chance of success. Ignore the evidence that living rationally would lead you to. This is filtered down into your education, even in primary school. You know, all kinds of ways it is now expressed, which it was not expressed last century before Seligman made this kind of thing popular. You know, you got all those phrases like, if you dream it, you can do it. Totally unrealistic expectations. You can do whatever you like in life. Just try. You can be prime minister. You can be an astronaut. You can be Olympic champion. Just set your goals, aim for them, and go for it. It's all yours. The world is yours. Totally mad. But it creates successful people. And we want successful people. So be mad. Well, what's all this got to do with meeting Jesus? Come with me for a few minutes and let me introduce you to him. See, to meet Jesus, the real Jesus, not the imaginary one, you must meet the historical Jesus, because Jesus was a man of history, living in the first 30 years of the first century before being rejected by his own people and being crucified by the Romans in Jerusalem. Now, that event was a public event, as crucifixions were, and it's recorded for us in history. It occurred in a minor backwater of the Roman Empire, a little province. One of thousands of crucifixions at the time. The Romans were good at crucifying people, and therefore of seemingly no significance or great importance, except that it has changed the course of human history ever since. No event has had a bigger impact on the history of mankind than that crucifixion of that man in Jerusalem. The ripples of that event have continued around the world and down history, so that today more people acknowledge Jesus than any other person in human history or anywhere else in the world. This is because people are convinced that though he was crucified, dead and buried, he didn't stay dead and buried, he rose from the dead. It's true that he rose from the dead, and the resurrection from the dead changes the meaning of life in every way. It's not simply that he performed a great miracle. I mean, it's not that this is the ultimate party trick to persuade you to become a Christian. It's not like that. In fact, he told us that no one would become a Christian just because someone rose from the dead. He said, you've got to understand what the resurrection means. You've got to understand what the prophets were expecting and what they're not expecting. But you can look at the evidences, any number of books on the evidences. Here's a book, The Resurrection of Jesus by Pincus Lapide. He was a Jewish scholar of the late 20th century, quite a Jew. He remained a Jew, but he looked at the evidences for the resurrection of Jesus and said, yes, it happened. Here's a book, weighty in tome and very useful, keeping your door open, by Professor N.T. Wright, going through all the arguments about the resurrection of Jesus, all the alternative theories that people have coming up with, and showing you that the alternatives don't make sense of the evidence. There's two. Carrying that one, I thought I won't carry any others for you down here. Got enough. But there are 30 or 40 books of people who have gone out to disprove the resurrection and, looking at their evidence, have come to believe in the resurrection. But it's not that he did a big miracle. It's what the miracle meant. This little book we're giving away, Uncover, See for Yourself. It's an opportunity to read it with someone else, if you like, just to go through to look at the evidences of the Gospel of John. I'm not going to rehearse all those evidences, but I want to show you the impact of the event, because that's part of the history. That's part of the evidences in the end, isn't it? That is, 30 years later in Rome, which is 1,000+ kilometres away from where Jesus was crucified, the Emperor Nero was able to blame the Christians for a fire in Rome that nearly destroyed the city. Now, just ponder that for a few minutes, friends. There were sufficient number of Christians who didn't exist before the resurrection of Jesus. There was a sufficient number of Christians in the capital city of the empire, which had about 1 million people living in those days. There was sufficient number of Christians to be known by the emperor of the world. Remember, their empire went from Scotland down to the bottom, to the south of India, to be known by the emperor of the world and to be sufficiently large inside Rome to be hated by the populace so that they would accept they were guilty of this fire. Something had happened back in Jerusalem in 30 AD for this to happen, for this persuasion to happen. I mean, it wasn't simply the crucifixion of another revolutionary. There were lots of those. That didn't change the world. Something else happened, something that turned the world upside down for people. They met a man who was far greater than their expectations. They killed him, and he came back. Now, that explains why there would be so... Look at the outline that you have in front of you and the passage that we just read. It comes from a letter to a whole group of new Christians who were living in Turkey. It comes before the fire in Rome. It comes about 62 AD. That is, about 30 years after Jesus. It was written by a man who was a strict monotheistic Jew. 30 years ago sounds like a long time for you, doesn't it? More than a lifetime, right? It's not long at all, let me assure you. I can remember what happened 30 years ago. It's not very hard. Nelson Mandela became president of the South Africa. Tony Blair became the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Tiananmen Square, the terrible protest that turned into a massacre in China, That happened that was the end of the 80s, so maybe 35 years ago. I can remember it. I can remember seeing the pictures of what's happening. Hey, personally, I can remember 30 years ago, in 2 months' time, 30 years ago, my daughter got married, and I can tell you where she got married. I can tell you who the groomsman was. I can even tell you the grandchildren I've got as a result. But 30 years ago is not a long memory time. And in fact, if you're going to write history, 30 years ago is important. Because writing history about what's happening today is very, very difficult. You need a space of time to get a bit of perspective on what happens and the consequences of it. So what did this letter say about Jesus? Well, I'm going to summarise it in the two paragraphs under four headings, as you'll see in the outline there, point three, under the historical Jesus. There are four headings: life, death, God, us. Firstly is the most extraordinary kind of claim about life. Jesus is described there as the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. The word firstborn in the ancient world meant the heir. You know, the oldest child inherited everything. The second, the next boys were sent into the colonies or put into the army. The girls were married off to other families. But the firstborn is the heir of everything. What's this firstborn heir of? He's the heir of all creation, everything that there is. Because all things were created through him, visible, invisible, everything, and all things were created, see at the end of the paragraph, for him. All of this life that we are in now is his because he made it and everything in it, and he made you. I told you it was an extraordinary claim, didn't I? It is, isn't it? Lots of people don't like the idea that they've been made, you know, and especially not made for something or somebody. I don't want to see myself as a manufactured item. But the alternative is what? I'm an accident? Accidents have no purpose. Accidents have no meaning. They just happen. And therefore, accidents don't actually have any significance. And therefore, without meaning, without purpose, without significance, you don't have any morality either. You're here because you're here because you're here because you're here. That's why you're here, because you're here. You are of no... Now, to have significance, you've actually got to be made by somebody for some purpose. And what this is saying, as the Bible is saying, is God made us all. But this passage is saying, made us all for this man. This was written 30 years afterwards. Secondly, he talks about death. In the second paragraph, it's not about creation, it's about the church, not the institutional church, the heavenly church. And again, he's called the firstborn, but this time he's called the firstborn from the dead. You'll see it halfway through, next to number little 18. So that in everything, this life and the life to come, now and after death, he is preeminent. He is surpassing all others. He's the greatest. He's the goat. Right? In fact, thirdly, his greatness is related to God. You see it in both paragraphs. In number 15, he's the image of the invisible God. You want to see God? You can't. He's invisible. You can, because he became a man. And you will see God in that man. It's a big claim. And 19, in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. Everything that you want to say about God, everything that you know about the one and only God who created the universe, everything you can say about God, you can say about Jesus, because he was God. Here, you see, you've got to think, here is a Jewish writer. Jews are fanatical. In the ancient world, they were almost unique in believing there's only one God, the one God who made everything, who's not a man, who rules all things. There is only one God. He believed in the Ten Commandments. It's blasphemy to call anything God other than the true and living God. There's no other God but Yahweh. And here he is, just 30 years after the death of Jesus, saying that this man, Jesus, was that God. Was God, and more than that, is God.
For he rules over everything in this world and in the world to come. He's the firstborn of creation and from the dead. This is the greatest blasphemy that any Jew has ever uttered, unless, of course, it's true. God visited this world in this man, Jesus? Well, more. You think, hey, more? Yeah, there's more. Fourthly, it's about Jesus' relationship with us. See, everything was created for him, so we were created for him. But look down to number 20 there. God was in Jesus reconciling all things to himself. Everything in this world, you see, is out of sorts. It's out of order. That's why we are so insecure in this world. But Jesus came to reconcile all things, put all things to rights, to turn the rebellious enemies of God back from their rebellion, turn people who are ignoring God back from their ignorance, turn people back by bringing forgiveness and new life. I mean, that's why the ruler of the universe died at the hands of Roman guards in the terrible crucifixion. For notice the end of the passage. He was making peace. How? By the blood of the cross. He put all things right by his death. Why does God become man in order to be crucified by a bunch of thugs? I mean, if he's God, why is he doing such a thing? He came to put all things right and bring forgiveness of sins to all peoples by paying the penalty for us. And so meeting Jesus confronts us with a question that he first asked his disciples. He said, "Who do people say that I am? Who do you say that I am?" Some of us here will have to be honest and say, well, frankly, I've got no idea. I've never looked at the history. I've never really read the Bible as an adult. I don't know who he is. And friends, if that's your case, Jesus is far too important to just leave it there. He may be a complete fraud. But if there's any hope that he is the truth, this is the most important truth you'll ever come to. So if you say, well, I've never really looked, here it is. It's available to you. Right? We want to read it. We want to read it with you if you'd like us to read it with you. But generally, people give an answer as to who Jesus is, whether or not they've looked at the evidence. It's the character of life, isn't it? Everybody knows who Jesus is. They just haven't actually checked up who Jesus is. And so there's hundreds of answers. If we did a little survey around the streets of the campus, I've done it before in this campus, they'll say, oh, he's a great teacher, he was a great leader, he was a prophet, he was a healer, he was a fiction, he was a fraud, he was a myth. There's all kinds of answers. But when you sum up all the hundreds of answers, you can actually see there's only four answers available to you. He's a liar, he's a legend, he's a lunatic, he's a legend, or he's the Lord. He's a liar, he claimed to be God, but he wasn't. He's a lunatic, he claimed to be God, and that puts him in the category of lunatic. He's a legend because, well, he didn't claim to be God, but the stories got better and better over the years, so that now, but he, you know, it's just a legend. Or he actually is God. He is the Lord. And if that's the case, I should submit my life to him. Is it? There are four alternatives for you to investigate. You want to keep the investigation simple. The key is finding the right question. Which of these four alternatives actually make sense of the evidence of Jesus? Look at some of the evidences. And then you work it out. Which? I don't think you'll find him lying. A teacher was never more truthful. And as he taught and lived the truth, you won't find him lying. And I don't think you'll find him a lunatic. A more sensible, sane man never walked the face of this earth. And I don't think he's a legend, because from the very beginning, the most extraordinary claims are made. Here it is, 30 years after him, and these extraordinary claims are made in the passage in front of you. This is not 300 years later. This is 30 years later. They were calling him God. That's not a legend that's got bigger and better as the years have rolled on. They knew what they were talking about. They knew dead men don't come back from the dead. They just came across a man who did, in fulfillment of a whole way of understanding life and death and reality. But what about Lord? Oh, and you see, the trouble with the Lord is it's not like the other three alternatives. I have an inbuilt bias against coming to this conclusion. Because if I find that he's a lunatic, I say, oh, that's interesting. If I find he's a legend, I say, well, fancy. Well, those people believe it, that's good for them. But if I find out he's the Lord, my life is changed. Nothing can remain the same. You see, I can't run my own life when I find out that actually it's not my life, it's his. So meeting Jesus of the past confronts us now in the present about the future. For meeting Jesus is not an academic pastime. It's not just an intellectual inquiry of no significance, but it's an existential confrontation. If he is the Lord of heaven and earth, then Jesus controls the future, and Jesus controls my future, both my future in this world and my future when I die. Because that's a grounds for insecurity, you know. The danger of life is no one gets out alive, don't you? And so he's dealing with that. Jesus then challenges me. Am I going to ignore him, continue rebelling against him, rejecting him? Or am I going to accept the forgiveness that he won for me, acknowledging him as my Lord and ruler? You see, while Professor Seligman can give you the irrational key to success in life, he can't provide you any sense of security. Because his key to success is being irrational. Just have a go. Harry Truman, he was an optimist. And he's buried 46 metres down under the pumice of an eruption. All the evidence should have made him a pessimist. He should have got off the mountain. But no, no. I want to be a winner. When you meet Jesus, you find security. For you now know who's actually in charge of the world. And surprise, surprise, it's not you. You're not God. Which is a great relief to the rest of us if you come to the mind that you're not. And you say, but Philip, are you saying that if I was a Christian, I wouldn't face any problems in the world now? There'd be no troubles for me. No, of course not. Of course not. But I am saying that you no longer need to live in security about them. See, the troubles of this world, you now know who's in control of them. And you know him and his love for you, and that actually it's somehow going to turn out to the best for you. Because you know about his purposes for life and his purposes for you. And you know about the strength that he will give you to endure the difficulties of life. And so you do not live in insecurity, but you live in security. Because you know who's boss. A boss who can beat death is a boss worth having, to put it mildly. But of course, that's secondary to the truth. You see, Christianity is not just a better Seligman. Christianity is the truth that Seligmans of this world can't find. So, who do you think Jesus is? Not, you'll notice, I ask, who do you think Jesus was? It's a fair question, was. But it really is the question. Now, there's two options for you now. One, I don't know, I need to investigate. Good. You've got that, haven't you? In fact, on the tear-off slip we're going to deal with in a little while, aren't we? There's options of questions like I'd like to follow Jesus. I'd like to learn more about Jesus. I'd like to join up with. There's all kinds of free things that Campus Bible Study is offering you. By all means, tick one of those when it comes to it. Because you say, I don't know. That's fair. You don't.
But don't stay ignorant. That's stupid. Because millions of people around the world and millions of people down history have found this is the answer. What's so special about you that you're not willing even to have a look? If you don't know the answer, that's all right. But if you do know the answer, then the next question really is, what are you going to do about it? Because there's no point in knowing about Jesus. You need to meet him. How do you meet him? Well, by talking to him. And what you say is, well, it's here on the back of the outline. It's a prayer I'm going to pray. I'm going to lead you in right now. It's the kind of prayer you need to pray to meet Jesus. But you'll notice the Jesus you meet in the last paragraph is Jesus as my ruler, because that's the real Jesus. Can't meet Jesus as your friend, as your boyfriend, or you can't meet Jesus. That's not meeting Jesus. You've got to meet Jesus who is the King. And so what the prayer says in the first paragraph is about yourself. I know I'm not worthy to be accepted. I don't deserve it. I'm guilty. I need forgiveness. If you don't know that about yourself, you're still a child. The second paragraph is thanking God. Thanking for sending his son to die for me that I might be forgiven and rise to give me new life. The third paragraph is the prayer of the prayer. Please forgive me. I need forgiveness. Jesus died that I'll be forgiven. Please forgive me. And change me. I can't go on living in rebellion against the truth of God. So change me. How do I change? To change me with Jesus as my ruler. I'm going to lead in prayer. I invite you to say amen with me. And if this is your prayer, especially your prayer for first time, if you know and it's true for years but never done anything about it, then I want to follow Jesus as the box to tick in a few moments when you're told about filling in the details. Let's pray, shall we? Dear God, I know that I'm not worthy to be accepted by you. I don't deserve your gift of eternal life. I'm guilty of rebelling against you and ignoring you, and I need forgiveness. Thank you for sending your son to die for me that I may be forgiven. Thank you that he rose from the dead to give me new life. Please forgive me and change me that I may live with Jesus as my ruler. Amen.